Welcome to Leading Lines, a podcast from Vanderbilt University. I'm your host, Derek Brough, the director of the Vanderbilt Center for Teaching. In this podcast, we explore creative, intentional, and effective uses of technology to enhance student learning, uses that we hope point the way to the future of educational technology in college and university settings. In this episode, we're going to kind of take that idea of enhancing student learning and go in a direction we haven't yet gone on the podcast, which is to actually talk to some students. Shocker. they have some ideas about how technology might enhance their learning experience. I have with me here Stacy Johnson. She is Assistant Director for Educational Technology here at the Vanderbilt Center for Teaching. And she has an interview to share with us with three graduate students here at Vanderbilt who are using technology to really kind of open up some doors in their own academic careers and go in some directions that I think are kind of surprising and interesting.
Hi, Derek.
Hey, Stacy.
So I sat down with Derek Price. No relation.
Right.
Kyle Romero and Terrell Taylor, and to talk about their podcast, Scholars at Play. They launched their podcast as an outgrowth of their interest in just video games at a recreational level, and also their interest in video games at an academic level. They are very aware of how the podcast that they're working on is preparing them for their possible future faculty role, what the university is and what it's becoming, and how the medium of podcasts and the work that they're doing on the podcast is sort of contributing to their future role as educators or as public scholars. It's also just a fun interview. They are fun guys, and I think people are going to enjoy listening to it.
Great.
I am here today with Derek Price, Kyle Romero, and Terrell Taylor, graduate students at Vanderbilt University. And I am so grateful that you guys took the time to chat with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
Happy to be here.
Great. Yeah.
That's a good start.
Yeah. Lots of affirmative soft
noises.
Yeah,
that's what you want.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I would love to start out with you guys just giving us a little introduction of yourselves, what you do here at Vanderbilt, and what you think of the other two.
And so you want to get into it right at the start.
Which one is your favorite?
Yeah,
that's right.
No, you can start, Derek.
Oh, okay.
As our fearless leader.
Okay, yeah, I guess that's me. So my name is Derek Price. I am a graduate student in the German Studies Department. I'm also in the Comparative Media Analysis and Practice joint PhD program, newly in that as of the end of this past spring semester. So, woo. My interests have shifted. I did philosophy in undergrad, and that sort of informed my interests going into grad school. But then as I've sort of shifted around, I've found my way to working on video games. And part of that interest found expression in this podcast that I put together with Kyle and Sorrell, which we can talk about more at length. But that started somewhere around November, and now I'm working towards a dissertation on the topic of work and play in sort of German gaming cultures. So, yeah.
Awesome.
We can talk more about that if you want to, but only
so
if you
more.
Really want to. Okay. That's enough for me.
A theme I've noticed in our podcast is we say, we'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
And then don't.
Perpetual deferral.
It's a good start. Yeah.
It creates a tension.
Yeah.
Endless deferral.
I'm going to make a note and not let you off the hook. About
we
it.
Must talk about Shoot. That thing later.
Kyle, Stacey, I think it's your turn.
Okay, great. I'm Kyle Romero. I just finished my third year. I'm a PhD candidate in the history department. I'm a little different from Terrell and Derek in that my dissertation is not on video games or gaming. I kind of came at the digital humanities and video games and game analysis kind of late in my academic career, or relatively late. I had already decided on my dissertation. I study the history of U.S. foreign policy in the 20th century, particularly the history of humanitarianism and the professionalization of humanitarian networks in the 20th century and how they dealt with refugee movements. So we don't have to get into that. Yeah, it's one of those really horrible things where, like, it's way too timely. And, you know, it's, like, way too accurate. And, yeah, I wish it wasn't as timely as it was, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So that's that. And in terms of games, you know, I was a fellow at the Vanderbilt Institute for Digital Learning this past year. I'm a Haystack Scholar, which is the Humanities, Arts, Science, Technology, something collaborative.
Associated Collaboratory.
Haystack.
Some of my favorite digital humanists have come out of Haystack.
Yeah, it's a great program. Mm-hmm. And so for those kind of digital humanities projects, I've focused on video games and particularly historically inspired video games and how historically inspired or historically situated video games have used history to make their games and also how they reinforce or break down certain ways of thinking about history. Oh, I really like Terrell and Derek. They're really great people.
I didn't do that.
Yes.
Yeah.
We get it, Derek.
How do I feel about both of them? Silence.
Speaks volumes. Speaks volumes.
So I'm Terrell. I'm going into my third year in the English PhD program here at Vanderbilt, and my academic interests are primarily in African-American literature within the 20th century, as well as the Caribbean, and thinking about the ways that Caribbean literature and culture and African-American culture circulate around ideas of cultural energy, vitality, and the ways that different ideas of what it is to live a life and to inhabit a life world are articulated by various nonfiction writers and fiction writers and poets in both of those canons. My interest in gaming is something I'm still really trying to develop and trying to think about how it can work with that, particularly the ways that gaming can be a very energizing experience, vitalizing experience, and the way that gaming gives you the capacity to experience a different form of embodiment, or that it can play with embodiment or play with mechanical difference to suggest a difference about a player avatar or a particular character, so on and so forth. Here at Vanderbilt, I've been getting involved with the podcast, looking into opportunities with Haystack and various other things, Vital, so on and so forth. Here at the Curb Center, we're in the process of putting together a video game archive, and this summer I've actually been working to pick out the games that both I like and are also very important and critical to belong in an archive. Delineating between those two can be quite difficult, but I'm really just sort of thinking about ways to have something to complement those academic interests that can be something of a digital project that can supplement or stand aside from the dissertation in interesting ways.
So not having a deep knowledge of game culture, I guess I'm wondering what kinds of video games would go in an archive. Can you give us a few examples of what games would fall into that category?
Sure. So the big questions I think we're tackling right now are, well, it depends on what it is that you want to focus on. For example, I think a few years ago, I want to say this might have been 2008 or 2009, the Library of Congress actually had a small sort of archive of games that were particularly important. And this was in the moment where we're in the sort of generation of the Xbox 360, the PS3, the Wii. All of these games were, most of them I think were Atari, and there may have been a few that were NES. So thinking about the games that sort of came out and sort of established, this is what it means to play a game. So for example, the original Super Mario Brothers, really important because in so many ways it sets up a kind of genre of the platformer, or a genre of what it means to sort of start playing a game. It establishes the idea of what lives are. So that's a really important thing to kind of get that in there. And then there are various other sort of moments that a genre sort of foments. So for example, around the mid-1990s, there's this thing called Metroidvania. So picking out the games that kind of begin that genre. And then separately, because we are at an academic institution, and this is something that I think is important just for video game studies, but also for academic and cultural interests writ large, I'm trying to think about ways that we can sort of build this archive so that various centers and places or nodes on campus could find it useful. So, for example, I've been in conversation with a few people who are involved with the Women and Gender Studies Department here, and trying to pick out games that I think do something interesting with the question of gender. And there are a handful of games I think really touch on that. So those are a couple of things I'm starting to get my hands into and think about this archive.
Really cool. Thanks. So how did you guys come about starting your podcast? How did that happen?
All right. Y'all can't hear that, but like Kyle just sort of gestures towards
I make a lot of like visual
ominously.
Jokes
yeah.
because
yeah,
it's very
really
good
sort
for
of,
the podcasting
yeah.
format.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Lots of visual jokes.
The visual is important
it's
for the
important.
Podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I started this as, actually I failed to mention this in my bio, but I'm also a Haystack scholar for last year during my third year. And this podcast was really, yeah, for Haystack, for those of you who aren't familiar with that grant, you are sort of encouraged to do a project for the year that involves the humanities, the arts, the sciences in some way. So I was here at the Curb Center for art, yeah. enterprise, and public policy. And I was sort of trying to think about what kind of a project I wanted to do. I've been listening to game podcasts a lot. And there was one person in particular, a guy named Austin Walker, who had been in a PhD program and had moved into sort of like the games journalism space. And I had been listening to this podcast for a while, and then he joined it, and he brought this sort of academic rigor to that space, which was not in no way an explicitly academic kind of podcast. But he posed really interesting questions that sounded like the kinds of questions that I liked to discuss in seminars and that kind of stuff. So I was sort of inspired by that, and just also since I had this opportunity to create something, I thought, you know what, I want to try and do a sort of almost like a mini seminar on games, and I want to do that as my Haystack project. So I put up little posters with a sort of like license, like a Creative Commons license picture on it of like a controller, which is still the logo for our podcast right now, in the graduate student carols, because I wanted to find some other graduate students who were also interested in games, because I didn't want to do this as like a sort of solo thing where I come up with a story or something like that and talk it through. As a person, I like to have conversations. That's kind of where I'm most comfortable. So that was it.
Yes, we had never met before the podcast.
Yeah.
And I think one of the kind of the coolest things for me was after our first episode, I like, you know, desperately showed the podcast to as many people as I possibly could. And my wife's first comment was like, wow, like, it sounds like you guys have known each other for a long time. You know, like you're just kind of, you know, friends, students hanging out, mm-hmm. talking about games in a kind of more formal academic setting. And I was like, that is exactly what we had wanted. You know, what Derek had imagined and what I completely agree with. We were trying to kind of model a graduate seminar. Because, you know, in a graduate seminar, there are jokes sometimes. Like, it can be fun, but the academic rigor is there. And so getting those kind of – all those aspects together was what made it for me.
And then just, like, the small note about the structure is that we sort of take – for each episode, we sort of pick an object, a game specifically, or a couple of games that fit in a specific category. And then we have a supporting text or two. One of those is academic always. Sometimes that third – object, text, whatever, is like a video essay or another podcast or a sort of review or like a blog post. And so we use those to ground the discussion and to give us a sort of shared common theoretical critical vocabulary that we, you know, we've all read it and we may or may not agree with it, but we can at least sort of meet each other using those terms. And I think that's been really successful in keeping the conversations, although the episodes tend to be about an hour long, they're pretty focused around a certain kind of theme or topic. So,
And the ideal would be that the listeners would also like read the text. I'm
Not
sure if that's ever happened, but maybe, you know.
It's very possible, Terrell, do you have any thoughts to add about the inception?
I guess it's just been great. The way it sort of spilled out into a number of other things. So, for example, I think that same time we were sort of getting things together with the podcast, there was the VAT camp. And I think we both did. You did one on podcasting. I'd sort of led a session on thinking about video games critically. And we've been doing things with Vandyland, so on and so forth. And so there's just
student club on campus.
Right. And I think even some professors have reached out to us about coming in and doing some things. And then,
well, I think part of the reason we were involved in the whole video game archive and that's a vital working group, the Digital Institute for Digital Learning working group, was that it was kind of known among the digital humanities people that like, oh, those are like our video game people. You know, those are the people interested in those things.
Yeah.
So we have had the opportunities to kind of spread out into to other things on campus. Yeah.
And one last note.
Keep going.
That sort of social aspect that has calcified around this podcast but spread beyond it. We've had guests on as well, a number of them, sort of one, two, three guests so far. We've got a plan for a fourth, and we're always actually five, where we have to plan for two more guests.
Yeah.
But just sort of building a sort of community of people on campus who are interested in games, because I knew that there were people. So, for example, my colleague Curtis Mann in the German department also sort of gave me an idea that it was possible to do a games dissertation in a German studies department. I knew he was interested in it, but I wanted – he was also in Germany for the last year and a half. And I was hoping to sort of find a way to bring a group of people interested in this topic together, because it's – there's no home for game studies at many universities. Sometimes it lives in the communications department. Sometimes it lives in media studies departments when those are there. Sometimes it's in English departments I think it's rarely in sort of foreign language departments like German for me. But I'm really happy with how the thing, like this podcast, has built a momentum that I'm really happy happened. So.
And I will say, I think just building off that, one of the really productive things of our podcast is our different kind of backgrounds, our departmental backgrounds, because it had never really been as apparent to me like how differently we all approach things in different departments. And I was a little worried coming into the podcast, like history kind of has a reputation as being like anti-theory, like we're just like, you know, people who like, you know, hang out in archives. And I mean, I do. But it just made me think about the way that like, no, there actually are theories in my field. It makes me think about things a little differently. And we can bring those together in productive and sometimes contrary ways, right? And I think that's been really cool.
I think that's actually one of the things that makes the podcast particularly strong, is that I think whatever our methodological tendencies are coming together, whether we, you know, compliment on them or not, I don't think we I don't think there's ever moments where I agreed with one of you and hated the other.
Yeah, yeah.
But just the collective pressure that we each kind of put on each other to sort of reform and make our ideas better.
Right.
Which is
what you get in a grad seminar, right? Like, that's exactly the goal.
That's great. So to explore a little bit more, like, the actual nuts and bolts of how you put together the podcast, Derek, I heard you mention in a meeting a couple months ago that you approach planning a podcast in a similar way to the way you approach planning a lesson for the classroom. And so that kind of sent my mind racing about what are the intersections between what you do in the classroom and what you do here. Maybe how do you put the podcast together in a way where it might be useful for people who are students of gaming? So you want to speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, of course. And I'm sure the other guys have thoughts about this as well.
Yeah, I just happened to overhear
that's
you
fair.
Say that.
That's
so
fair.
I mentioned
Derek,
you, no. But everyone
Derek is the
welcome.
Smartest of us, so it's probably good to start with this.
Super not true.
It's reason you're a fearless leader.
Basically, like, making yourself legible to audiences who may not have a shared context. I know that we have listeners that aren't in graduate school. So important to us, I mean, we have show notes, basically, that we use. I mean, this is a common thing for podcasts. We attempt to sort of order that in a way that that sort of slowly introduces each object that we're going to discuss. So, like, important for me is this sort of triangulation. I always want to have generally, like, one game or a series of games that are very close to each other, one academic text and maybe a third academic text or that other sort of more accessible kind of a text or video. And we sort of go sequentially one by one. We start with a game if it feels relevant. Sometimes we start with – in fact, often we've started with texts instead. And what we started doing around episode 3 was divvying up each object to one of us, and we sort of – give a quick 5-minute summary of that thing, highlighting the terms or the arguments that are most helpful or interesting to the topic at hand. And then after we've sort of established that some sort of summary, that's when we sort of launch into a discussion of, like, how did we each what was our experiences with this text or this game, what stood out to us, and then we start engaging with each other in that argument. So yeah, it's a simple structure. It's not super complicated or novel, I don't think, but depending on the things we're talking about, it makes more sense to start with one or the other thing. So, yeah, I don't know. Do you feel like I hit most of the structural things for the how we organize it?
Yeah. I think it's really the kind of critical task, and the thing that makes it similar to planning a lesson is you want the sort of excitement of, okay, here are these things bouncing off of each other, but you also want the groundedness of here are things that can be concisely described maybe within 5 minutes, or people have enough time to sort of read them or play them so that they can get a sense of what's going on. And that balance between, okay, we have some confines, but we also have something that's expansive, I think is the kind of dynamic that's critical to a podcast or a lesson.
I think of it similarly, too, to how I would plan for classes, for graduate seminars, in that I would, you know, play the game, kind of take notes, read the text, take notes, and, like, have that exist and sit on it for a day, and then go through those notes and really look through and be like, okay, like, where are the connections, where's the connectivity? And then also look for, similar to when I plan lessons for teaching, is like, what are, like, teachable moments, you know, or, like, moments in this that are particularly, like, useful and, you know, interesting and, you know, funny sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so I'll have, you know, lots of notes, same way I prep a lecture in saying, like, okay, we'll all lay out these points. Maybe Derek will say something, Terrell will say something, I'll say something. And then there's a moment where it's really important to talk about X, you know. So for one of our episodes, we talk about the game Sid Meier's Civilization. And I say it's really important that we talk about the technology tree at some point, you know. And so I would kind of wait for a moment where it came up and be like, okay, good. I have all these notes on this thing and we'll talk about it. So kind of prepping moments as well as the kind of like in that structure that Derek laid out.
And I think there's an interesting duality at work because we're not just sitting around a table having a working group. We're actually recording a podcast. When I thought of lesson planning, the way that I think about it is more, I mean, it's like it's both, but it's more like, how do I make sure that the three or four of us continue to have a good discussion? And so in that way, I'm prepping more for a conversation with equals who have equal access to the same kind of texts that I've read. That's always my first and foremost in my mind when we put the show notes together. I started making the structure, but we've sort of ended up working in that all together. But also at the same time, there's that obvious part, which is that we're making this for other people to listen to. And In thinking about that, you mentioned before we started recording of like thinking of these things as a model or as a thing to be assigned to listen to and maybe to get a sense of and then to, I think, later discuss whether or not they are important conveyors of information or if like these podcasts are meant so that you come away knowing more about game studies or about that game. I'm not so sure about that. I would be more sure of the fact that what we're doing is modeling discussion, basically, and how a seminar can function. So that's something that's been on my mind a lot for thinking about how to plan these things. And like, there's two different kinds of lesson planning happening, essentially.
Yeah, I don't know if you'd either of you'd agree with this, but I feel like as much as I learn in sort of the prep for the podcast, I learn just as much, if not more, in art exchanges and the steering of the conversation. So in terms of self-directed learning, the podcast kind of models that in ways.
Right.
So I'm wondering if what you're doing in the podcast is having any effect on what you're doing in the classroom or if there are any intersections there.
Well, I desperately tried to hide that I'm on a video game podcast so my students would respect me.
Like right now we're producing, like this is an active The language of activity is tricky, but I think it's for the three of us, it's active in a way that it might not be for a listener. They're probably not reading the texts because we're not advertising what we're doing before we play the episode. So like you can't even know what you're supposed to read before you listen or before you download it and look at the show notes.
That's why we put like 4 months in between all the episodes.
Right, you know, exactly.
To give them time.
Right. To like look at it, stop listening, go get the texts, read them, play the games, and then come back.
Yeah.
Because they really, really want that good content. I think so. It's an active process for us. It's probably more of a, let's be real, borderline entertainment for people who are listening. It's like both modeling interesting conversation, but also kind of entertainment. I think it's good to be upfront about that. But one thing that it could be for the future is because we're all learning how to make a podcast and how to organize it and like using the technology doesn't have to be everyone has their own mic and they have a pop screen and you have Logic Pro open and you're doing all of this in the special booth. You can have a lot lower tech version. And by making this podcast a bunch, we'll be able to get our students to sort of make podcasts and sort of introduce them to that as a method of working through things, of like, you know, I think it just raises the stakes for a conversation and would really forces you to know your stuff and be ready to talk about something. And so I think it might, and also because it sounds kind of fun and like instead of like, yeah, go ahead and have a conversation in front of the class, like go home, record this thing, plan it out, tell me what you want to accomplish with it. And I see it as practicing for like showing other people how to produce their own podcasts. That's the...
So I'm going to try and just recap that a little
bit.
So what I heard you say was that it's not necessarily affecting your teaching right now just because of the level you're teaching.
I think so, yeah.
These aren't skills that transfer immediately.
Not quite, yeah.
However, in your future faculty career, are you planning on being faculty?
It's always a dream. It's always a hope.
So in a potential
I don't know if you
future...
saw that really sad article about, it's like, be a manager for $28,000 a year of 10 graduate students and teach 3 classes and also 67% health care.
Yeah.
I don't know if y'all saw that. But yes, I would. I like the kind of work that happens in academia. And if I could get a job in it, I think that'd be fantastic.
Okay. Yeah. So I was just, some people, it's not even their goal in their PhD program. So I was just checking in on
that. Yeah, fair.
In your future, in a potential future faculty mm-hmm. role, that you would harness these skills to really be able to give students an insider view on how to make a podcast and teach them how to craft an argument, craft a story, produce something that might have a larger, more authentic audience than what we normally do in classes through podcasting. Or if you end up teaching comparative media, mm-hmm. you might actually be able to assign these podcasts as sort of models of what class discussion should be like. Is that
that's much better and quickly said than what I said. So that's fantastic. That's great.
Well, maybe this should just be me recording what I think
better.
You meant to say.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, we're going to be bringing you in. So Derek went on for 5 minutes, and here's the
you can just hear your voice in the background. Like, so
yeah,
here's
like
what
they faded out. Yeah, that sort of reply
that,
all.
I have always
version.
Wanted to
that.
Do that kind of podcast. Today might be the day.
Perfect.
So, Terrell, do you have any other sort of insights on the intersection between what you do in the classroom and what you've been doing in the podcast?
Yeah, so I think the big thing that I've most consciously thought about is the fact that the courses I'm teaching now are supposed to teach students writing. And the sort of place I'm at thinking about that is that teaching writing effectively is about teaching them different types of intellectual /, I guess, expressive moves. And moves are things that happen within a podcast. So, for example, when two people are going back and forth and the third kind of intervenes from a particular way, that's a kind of intervention or a type of action happening in that kind of expressive space. And I think that we understand, we have a feel for that, and we kind of know that, especially if we listen to certain podcasts over and over and over again, certain voices or certain personalities start to come out and they kind of become known for doing certain things in a certain way, not in a kind of reductive sense, but we kind of, you know, we tend to gravitate towards certain character effects of a personality as they come to form in a podcast. And that's something that at once, I think, is what Derek was saying, demonstrates good discussion skills and what it means to have a good conversation. So what I want to look for in a good class participation or a good class discussion, I think students can learn that from a podcast. But and I don't know if I want to necessarily get to the point where they're close reading podcasts.
God, no, please.
But I think it's important. And I can definitely say that video games actually did this for me in a particular way. A particular video game show that I used to watch growing up with Adam Sessler, who's no longer in video game studies or media or criticism. But a lot of the ways that he would talk about games influenced the way that I began to write. And something about that kind of persona and the sort of way that he would approach them, the kind of way he would kind of carry himself, the fact that it was fun, the fact that it was exciting, whether it was talking about whatever PlayStation 2 game was out, there's something about that that I could then take into writing about Shakespeare or writing about the Battle of Agincourt. And if I could somehow get that connection going, and that, I think, is the thing that I'm sitting on right now.
I think there's something really valuable to be said about the funness, accessibility of video games. That's something that, again, if I become a faculty, you know, maybe one day, that's the dream. I'm really deeply interested in public history, kind of like getting into the community and accessing, you know, more people than just like inside the classroom. And is there really, like, especially in 10, 15 years, like everyone's going to be playing video games, right? Everyone already does now, even if it's an app on your phone or something on Facebook or whatever. Like everyone games in some way or another now. So it's going to be omnipresent, you know? And is there a better way to access beyond the classroom into the public more than saying like, okay, well, let's like think critically about these things, right? Like let's try to inculcate ways of thinking, ways of knowing, ways of talking to each other, even about something that's really fun and interesting and intuitively we understand. So to grow those kind of networks outside of the college, something I want to do, and games are a great way to do it.
That's great. So what are your highest hopes for the podcast?
Ooh. Oh, man. I don't want to be too dramatic, but the university is changing and there are structural things happening outside the university that are affecting it, political, economic things. And I think the university can't afford to be a closed space anymore. I mean, it's not anymore. And it can't afford to think of itself in that way anymore. So I think that sort of public-oriented or at least work that's done that could be accessible to the public, like a podcast, is not only a nice thing to do and play around with, but like actually essential to the future of whatever the university becomes.
Great.
What do you guys think?
Anyone else? Do you have high hopes for the podcast?
I mean, I'm pretty similar to Derek. Like, I think that'd be great. I'm going to get a little too like Aaron Sorkin-y here, you know, but like, I think there's something to be said for like increasing the quality of conversation, like in the United States, in the world, you know, and that, I mean, I don't know. Like, is a podcast about video games going to solve everything? Like, are we going to fix all the problems? Yeah. But I think there's something to be said for, like...
Gaming journalism has suffered from some bad press. And yeah, I think the quality conversation is well needed.
Yeah. So I think just inculcating modes of conversation that are based on, like, mutual respect, based on, like, production of knowledge, not based on, like, fear and anger, right? That'd be great.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, something kind of great about our podcast that's already kind of happened is, according to SoundCloud, we have a listener in Kuwait.
We have,
right? We have listeners in Eastern Europe.
Yes.
In Mongolia.
There's the Mongolian cohort.
Which I'm not sure how these people
they
found.
They get together every Sunday to listen to your podcast.
Every 4 months.
Yeah, every 4 months. Kyle's riding me on this. It's rough, man.
He would like a faster schedule, please.
It's true.
Because he's not a graduate student like the rest of us.
Yeah, I have so much free time, guys.
Right.
Are these people, like, how did they find us? Are they listening to the podcast? Do they, like, I don't know. But just the fact that maybe someone in the world, like, listens to this and is like, this is kind of neat, you know? Like, mm-hmm. It's mind-blowing to me that, like, something that we do in Nashville, Tennessee, in this little room in the Curb Center can have an effect on someone across the world, right? And so just kind of magnifying that would be my dream for the podcast. My life, like, just, like, generally.
I'm going to risk the indulgence of sentimentality here. We have a Slack channel and a few others, and I've definitely been the most sentimental, you know, gushy-gushy one. Interacting with Derek and Kyle, Team SAP, as I sometimes abbreviate us.
Scholars at Play.
It's our podcast. Name of the podcast.
It's the one we do.
Team SAP.
Has been, to throw a couple of obscure references out there, has been like Mother Base in the Phantom Pain, or the Normandy in the Mass Effect series, or to throw something out, hopefully we'll hit the Enterprise in Star Trek.
Yeah.
It has been kind of the sort of base of operations for a number of very productive things as we sort of reached out on campus to do a bunch of connections and really start thinking about games in a kind of intellectual and rigorous way that's still very accessible. And that is part of what kind of brought me to grad school and to academia. I think that developing that in our own terms, in our own ways, I mean, yeah, Derek, you just produced a video essay on a video game. And the number of video essays that I watched prior to meeting any of you or again being here at Vanderbilt, the fact that you have one is really inspiring to me. And I hope that maybe we can move forward with that. We have a bunch of ideas that we want to do sort of here and now. And I hope that we kind of each are able to do that together, but also kind of have our own various projects and investments. I think we all kind of want to do some form of blogging and have video games be sort of part of that. And that, you know, eventually, sadly, we may have to, you know, upon leaving Vanderbilt, go our separate ways.
Yeah.
But just to know that it all kind of began here. If it lands, great. But if it doesn't land, it's still a part of the craft and I think what drives us in our own respective ways. So,
I love you too, Terrell.
Yeah. Lots of love.
Okay, so one last question. I don't know if it'll go anywhere, but
Do our answers ever go anywhere?
Well, one last idea is I was thinking about at the Center for Teaching, we talk a lot about students as producers. In grad school, there's sort of a production track where you produce small papers and then you produce a dissertation, and there's often just not room in that time to produce other kinds of things. You guys are already producing a podcast. You're producing video content. You're talking about blogging. You're producing and making connections really outside of the traditional grad student role. So I wonder if you have any insight into what the formula might be, why you have been able to be successful sort of producing really rigorous, interesting academic content in different modalities besides the traditional sort of grad student role.
I mean, for me, I think part of it is kind of like, it's kind of sad, but like the functions of like the market in the past couple decades
where
like
absolutely.
It's been kind of made apparent that like you just have to do this, you know, like to me, you know, that like if you really want to be an academic now, you have to kind of pursue other modalities. It's not like I was forced into this or like, ugh, I have to, you know, go every couple months and record a podcast with these jerks, right?
But every 4 months.
Every 4 months. Every 4 to 8 months. Okay.
Wow. Okay. I think we've existed for 9 or 10.
Yeah. But yeah, so that like it's great that being able to do this is both fun and productive for me, as well as I think increasingly becoming a necessity in the market for academia.
Great.
It's a good answer.
I know.
Part of what like makes it possible, I know for sure, is that when I was very young, teenager, I was like in bands and we tried to record demos. So
Rag.
I have, yeah, I mean, they were super good. Let me know if you want a copy. I can definitely gonna put it up on Bandcamp.
You guys can get me a bootleg copy. We'll put it in the show notes.
That'd be great. God. I would also love to hear
God.
That.
And I have a familiarity and an ease or just a confidence with technology and that kind of stuff that was just like, oh, yeah, I'll figure it out. You know, I'll just get the tools. They'll all be there. And then the Curb Center has this studio that we're sitting in right now. So that also enabled it. I mean, I got the Haystack grant that enabled it. So there's a whole like bunch of things that I was lucky enough to get.
But I think there's actually a formula we can derive from that. You have a funding source from people who did know what your product would be but were willing to invest in you.
Yes.
You had the ability developed. So one of the problems that I see with technology, the way it's usually used in education, is students are expected to do things really quickly with no in-class training, right? So put on a podcast. We're not going to learn how to do it in class, but here's a PDF tutorial you can follow, right?
Right.
So, but you had years of training in different kinds of audio production before you actually started podcasting. So you could just jump in.
Exactly.
And then the third, the Curb Center actually provided you with the really professional quality resources you needed to do a good job.
I think two things is what you just said really kind of captures what I was thinking towards this question. So I think when it comes to academia, a thing that we are, I don't even want to say we're necessarily discouraged from admitting it as graduate students or even people who are interested in academia, is that part of what brought us here at some point in time was the kind of, you know, dream Luke Skywalker watching the Rebel Alliance move around, and we want to do that. Like, you know, we saw something on TV that kind of grabbed us. Maybe it was a teacher. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was a scholar in a particular forum. Maybe it was a speaker. And something about this, like, really enchanted us, and that's what sort of moves us forward. That kind of, you know, light in the eyes. And then once you kind of get and start to realize that, you know, the drudgery of a dissertation and some other things can be a little bit a bit heavy, you know, that kind of gets toned down and sort of managed. But I think to a certain degree, in part, and maybe this is true for all of us, you know, we listen to podcasts and we think, wow, that would be something really cool to do. I would love to kind of have an opportunity to sit and engage with some people in the way that I'm sort of listening to that. And that kind of attraction, that sort of passion that you were just talking about, I think is an important sort of element to the recipe. And I also think of the question of training, right? It's funny to you know, Derek, you mentioned that you had your band and you did some recording.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, would you have called that training?
No.
Right.
Yeah, I definitely wouldn't have. No.
And to the same degree, can I really call myself getting home and watching X Play on Tech TV every home, training to write essays or to think about games criticism?
Yeah.
Maybe not. And that there's ways of training, there's ways of exposure, there's modes of just kind of social engagement with culture that in fact develops skills or develops levels of familiarity, levels of competency. And that's where I think DH is kind of trying to meet pedagogy in interesting ways now. It's like we all interact with tablets and touchscreens. There are certain competencies by virtue of how we've become sort of fluent with various, most obvious example coming to mind is like something like AIM or chat and the ways that there are certain shorthands. Like that's a technology, that's a fluency, that's a currency that, you know, certain generations have. How do you tap into that and say, okay, well, what can you do with that to meet something real? I think that that's a kind of important part of the recipe that doesn't necessarily require you to have years of formal training, but what have you been trained without knowing it as training? It's an important element.
Yeah. It's almost like sort of enjoyment, pleasure, sort of play and work are sort of merging together there.
Late stage capitalism.
Also my dissertation topic.
Well, I had a really fun conversation with you guys. Thank you so much.
Great.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks. This has been great.
This was fun.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, bye.
See you.
Outro.
As Kyle mentioned, it's time for the outro. That was a really fun interview, Stacey. Having listened to a few episodes of Scholars at Play, I was surprised to find out that they had actually not known each other before the podcast. They've got a really great rapport, the three of them.
And I have to say, stepping into their studio with them as the fourth, I really felt like the four of us had a great rapport and we should start our own podcast about something related to podcasts.
That's very meta. Well, and I should add, I mean, you've shared with me, you actually sat down with them for more than an hour and edited lots of fun stuff out.
Yeah, we try to keep the content of this podcast to mostly about higher education, teaching and learning. So the 10-minute stretch about the importance of Super Mario, we left that out, even though I felt like I made some really important intellectual contributions
Nice. So we'll put a link to the Scholars at Play podcast in our show notes. And so certainly if our listeners would like more video game theory, that's the place to go. And I got to say, I was also struck by just how intentional these three young scholars are in exploring this kind of new space in academia. And I think it's new in a couple of ways. One, they're in the area of video game studies, which doesn't have a traditional academic home, as was mentioned in the interview. And so it's in this kind of interdisciplinary liminal space as an academic area of study. And so they're having to kind of chart their own course there. And they're also using this new technology of podcasts to create a venue or a forum where they can actually do the kinds of work that they want to do as scholars. And I think that's just really impressive, and I think it gives us a little insight into how grad students might be thinking about their own education and their own careers and kind of creating venues for the kind of work that they want to do.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And one thing that I have mentioned before is that these three are very aware of the state of the academic job market. They have a lot of insight also just into the state of the university, sort of what research and scholarship looks like right now in the modern university and what it might look like when, if they are ever in faculty careers. For a graduate student, there is a traditional path of writing and publishing and writing a dissertation and then publishing that. And they have begun publishing right now using new media in a way that is really accessible, as they mentioned, even to people in Mongolia.
Right. And, you know, it's something I have observed, especially in the kind of broader digital humanities area, is that as humanities scholars are looking at digital media, as they're finding new forms of scholarship, our grad students are often having to kind of really struggle to find a way to blend that with more traditional forms of scholarship. And so, you know, I've talked to grad students who will write a traditional dissertation, but they'll have that one chapter where they have this really cool GIS project in the middle of it, right? And so it's interesting to see perhaps a slightly more integrated approach, thinking about not just kind of one chapter in the dissertation, but the work that they're doing here at Vanderbilt and using these new tools to kind of explore spaces that they're really interested in. And you had mentioned that it's actually kind of put them on the map here at Vanderbilt.
Yeah, so that's another thing. The three of them in their individual departments, English, History, and German Studies, all had this interest that they were developing. But it wasn't until they came together and started building this podcast together that they were sort of recognized locally on campus as experts in this area. So it's given them a lot of opportunities on campus and in other groups related to their campus experience to be invited to be a presenter or a speaker or to contribute some expertise in game studies.
Well, and I think it gets me thinking about the ways that we as faculty and instructors might be able to help and support this type of activity. I mean, you noted in the interview the kinds of resources and mentoring and support that these three have received, right? They brought a lot to the table themselves, certainly, but there were some resources here at Vanderbilt that helped kind of move them along a little bit. And even if we have our students who are, you know, even if our students are exploring academic areas or technologies that we're not that familiar with, there may be ways for us as instructors to still at least allow them and encourage them to kind of do that exploration. I know a lot of grad students run up against just roadblocks trying to do anything that's kind of away from tradition. Yeah.
So one thing I'd like to say, and I'm sure you've heard me say this several times, is it's possible to have a really tightly controlled project that you engage students in and get really consistent results. However, if you open that up and don't give students as many constraints and don't control as tightly, you are opening them up both to succeed beyond your wildest expectations and to fail in ways that are going to provide them learning experiences that your tightly controlled project cannot. And so whenever I have a choice of controlling my students' output more or controlling my students' output less, I try and err towards less and really open it up and see what they can do. And I think what these graduate students were given is a testament to that. An open-ended grant to do something interesting in the digital humanities, a fully functional stocked space to create what they needed to create, and just a lot of faith and trust from the people who are mentoring them that they could bring their talents to bear in an interesting way.
Well, thanks for the interview, Stacey.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. In a future episode, we'll have another interview with a Vanderbilt colleague on video games and teaching. Jay Clayton, a professor of English, brings video games more intentionally into his own classroom space. We'll get to kind of continue talking about some of these topics. In the meantime, if you'd like to hear Scholars at Play, you can find a link to their podcast in our show notes. And you can find those show notes as well as past and future episodes of Leading Lines on our newly renovated website, leadinglinespod.com. We now have a nice tag cloud on there, so you can easily find episodes by topic, and our search functionality covers all of our transcripts. Almost all of our episodes have full transcripts, and those are searchable as well. You can also follow us on Twitter at leadinglinespod, and you can send us a voice memo with your thoughts on this episode to leadinglinespod@vanderbilt.edu. I stole that idea from Stacy and her podcast. Leading Lines is produced by the Center for Teaching, the Vanderbilt Institute for Digital Learning, the Office of Scholarly Communications at the Vanderbilt Library, and the Associate Provost for Digital Learning, John Sloop. This episode was edited by Stacy and produced by Rhett McDaniel. Look for new episodes the first and third Monday of each month. I'm your host, Derek Brough. Thanks for listening.